You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of April 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme...
It is clear that we see no further role for the Assad regime longer term, given that they have effectively given up their legitimacy with these type of attacks.
G7 leaders wrap up their meeting in Italy on the Syrian conflict, but as US Secretary of State Rex Tillerson heads to Moscow, will he be able to pressure Vladimir Putin to break ties with Assad? My guests today, Victor Bulmer-Thomas and Phil Clark, will discuss this and the day's other top stories, including the US prepares for North Korea's anniversary celebrations by deploying its Navy to the Korean Peninsula. We ask what the latest crisis in President Jacob Zuma's presidency means for South Africa and how an overbooked United Airlines flight escalated into a worldwide PR disaster. That's ahead on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Hey, warm welcome to this edition of Midori House. My guests today are Victor Bulmer-Thomas and Phil Clark. Victor's an Associate Fellow in the Americas Programme at Chatham House, and Phil is a reader in Comparative and International Politics at SOAS, University of London. Welcome both to the programme. Very good to have you with us. Let's start in Italy, where foreign ministers from the G7 nations met in Lucca to discuss the ongoing conflict in Syria. The group rejected a proposal by the UK which wanted to implement sanctions against Russia in the wake of the chemical attack carried out by the Syrian regime. Victor, perhaps we'll start with you. What did you make of that decision specifically? It was interesting that Italy's foreign minister said the group didn't want to be seen or to actually be backing Russia into a corner, preferred dialogue. Does that sort of logic wash?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I'm not surprised that they didn't apply further sanctions, because Russia is already subject to numerous sanctions, not to do with Syria, of course, but it hasn't changed its behavior in any way. So there's no reason to assume that it would do so in the case of Syria. And so I think they reached the pragmatic solution, which is much better to try and reestablish some sort of dialogue, particularly now you have a new administration in the United States. And we shall see, but the position of the G7 is extremely weak, and that was probably recognized in the conversations.
And it's interesting, I suppose, if we look at the fact that there wasn't agreement broadly or at all on this Russia sanctions, there does appear to be a little more agreement, Phil, around this idea that, you know, the future of Syria maybe is not the future of Assad.
Yes, and this is a fairly significant shift over the last week or two, particularly from the US. There had always been a sense coming out of Trump's camp from the election campaign onwards that they were very happy to live with an Assad regime for the sake of peace and stability. But clearly that has changed very recently. And I think, in fact, the entire US strategy towards Syria has changed dramatically over the last week. So I think that's one of the great uncertainties in all of this is, you know, is there any kind of sober calculation going on inside Trump's camp about what the strategy in Syria is? What does the long term look like? Or is this all being done on the hoof? At the moment, it looks like it's being done on the hoof. And I think that includes this statement that that the future of Syria means no Assad.
Victor, I wonder then, to pick up on that point, US Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, who we heard from at the top of the show, he's moved on from the G7 meeting in Italy. He's arrived in Moscow for talks. What does that look like? Because presumably, I guess neither side, even a few weeks ago, would have anticipated this exact turn of events in the preceding few days. What would be your best guess about that sort of dialogue?
I think it's a bit of a sideshow. He's not meeting Putin. He has many opportunities to meet Lavrov. I can't imagine that there will be anything of substance. Of course, it's good that they're meeting. It's good that they're talking. It's good that he's gone there. But the key players are not going to be present at part of that discussion. And the key players, clearly on the Russian side, Putin, but on the US side, it's increasingly what you might call the establishment defense figures, people like McMaster and James Mattis, and a number of others as well. And that, I think, is the really crucial, because to the extent that Trump is willing to delegate, if you like, it will be these people who take the decisions. And they come out of a very traditional Cold War, if you like, mentality. But to the extent that Trump gets involved, then, of course, you're likely to see a slightly different approach. And right now, it's very difficult because you're getting different signals according to who is leading these discussions. So while I agree with Phil that there has been a change of mood coming out, or change of policy position coming out of Washington in the last week, it could change again very quickly, depending on which of these two sides is choosing to become more dominant.
And Phil, that therein is the problem, isn't it? It's so difficult to predict Trump and whichever person he tasks with making the pronouncements of the day. Do you think we should get used to this idea that these decisions are mainly being based on the desire to sort of win the news cycle rather than win the war? I mean, that's a fairly cynical view, but I mean, do you think that's probably accurate?
I do think that's part of it. I think Trump's plummeting popularity at home undoubtedly underpins this decision to fire 58 missiles into a site in Syria. I think that's a big push for this, you know, change in atmosphere that we've seen coming out of Washington in the last week. And that's a really concerning thing, because it shows that, you know, electoral whims, which can change extremely quickly, can be driving a decision as important as whether you attack a foreign country. So I think there's the sort of Trump's electoral volatility. But the other thing that seems to be underpinning this is this constant shuffling of key characters in Trump's administration. So whether it's, you know, Steve Bannon being removed from the National Security Council, the kind of the rise of Jared Kushner, the, you know, this kind of constant change of characters and aims and objectives, I think is also part of this volatility. And that's a very frightening thing. Because what we have here is one of the world's great powers that is extremely trigger happy, extremely unpredictable, and I think it's going to be very choppy waters ahead.
How worrying is that then? You've got this sort of, if not changing personnel, just this changing emphasis, presumably depending on what side of the bed Trump gets out of in the morning. How does a country, perhaps the critical country in global policy terms, deliver any kind of coherence in its whole foreign policy agenda, far less on something very specific and very challenging like Syria, when we don't have the personnel that are fit for purpose?
Well, I'm not quite as concerned about that as perhaps Phil is, because it seems to me there has been quite a significant shift, and I think a permanent shift, at least as far as foreign policy is concerned, away from what you might call the radical right, the Steve Bannons of this world, and indeed the Michael Flynns of this world, towards a much more establishment approach to foreign affairs. And Kushner isn't necessarily going to disagree with, say, McMaster or Mattis, yet alone with Trump. And when it comes to Syria, it's pretty clear, and Trump has been quite consistent about this, and no one in his administration is contradicting him, the number one priority is defeating ISIS. And the fact is that all this talk about Assad and he can't play a part in the future, et cetera, that in the end is going to have to be subordinate to the defeating of ISIS, because I think they're sincere when they say that is the number one priority, because that does actually touch on US national strategic interests.
And I guess one of the other challenges then, if we look at that bigger picture and that broader challenge, is still how you galvanize support for whatever you decide to do from all the actors involved. And we always say quite often then at the table, in this case, you've got Tillerson's in Moscow. How effective is that going to be? Does the United Nations have a voice, and so on and so forth? Is there a way, if that is the broader challenge, to look at IS? I mean, we've talked before in this program about how complicated it is to tackle such a nebulous thing as IS. Where does that process begin? And are the personnel then there to even start on doing that?
Well, there's not just a strategy in the case of ISIS. There's actual military action, and it's taking place in Iraq and Syria as we speak. Of course, it's in a part of Syria which is not controlled by Assad. It's around Raqqa and other places. So that will continue. And in fact, I imagine it will get beefed up because there's a broad coalition in support of that. And those who are not part of that coalition, other than ISIS itself, are not going to undermine it. So that will take a lot of energy and time from the team around Trump.
Well, let's move on and turn the focus now toward the Korean Peninsula. A US Navy strike group is travelling towards it ahead of North Korea's anniversary celebrations. The moves prompted Pyongyang officials to respond by saying that if the US dare opt for a military action, the People's Republic is ready to react to any mode of war desired by the United States. Phil, this is essentially a country at least saying explicitly that it's on a war footing, that it's ready for war. Do we need to worry about that particular outcome?
I think this is pretty serious in the sense that we know North Korea has nuclear capabilities. We know that they have tested much longer range missiles recently than they have in the past. The rhetoric coming out of Pyongyang seems to have escalated. And I think connected to that is perhaps the most worrying part of this, which is that the US is clearly taking it very seriously in sending an aircraft carrier to just off the Korean Peninsula. So, you know, the scope for massive escalation here. And again, I think this is connected to our discussion recently about Syria. It's the same trigger-happy, sort of somewhat unpredictable characters in Washington that are making very similar noises about North Korea at the moment. And in fact, Tillerson connected the two cases in a statement yesterday saying that, you know, just as we fired missiles into Syria because of its chemical weapons attack last week, all countries that may use chemical or nuclear weapons against their civilians or neighboring states could attract very similar military attention from the US. So, yeah, the scope for escalation is serious now, I think.
And Victor, obviously, it's another hornet's nest that one fears poking the stick into. And there's a different, there's a sort of a propaganda or rhetorical battle as well. We're going to see huge parades, of course, in North Korea to celebrate the birthday of the founding president and so on and so forth. When there's that sort of thing happening and nations' leadership in those places also seeking to make capital on the world stage to a greater or lesser degree, does that make it more difficult for the US to, I don't know, keep their distance and not respond? How do they maintain a safe distance?
This is a much more difficult situation, but at the same time, it's a very different situation from Syria. You can't lob 59 Tomahawk missiles into Pyongyang and not expect a massive retaliation, however suicidal that may turn out to be. So that simply isn't an option. You either go in full throttle, 100%, or you don't go in at all. And, of course, the arguments for and against going in full throttle are well known. And my sense is that given the personnel around Trump that we talked about earlier on, that no one is seriously thinking about going in full throttle. So I think what we're going to find out in the next 6 to 12 months is just how much leverage China does or doesn't have over North Korea. And secondly, just how rational or irrational Kim Jong-un is. I myself am not as concerned about this as many people are, actually. I've always regarded Kim Jong-un and his father and grandfather as being fairly rational actors. Of course, they do the rhetoric fantastically. I mean, they put everyone else to shame when it comes to the rhetoric. All those, the first time he played golf, you know, he managed 9 holes in one in an 18-hole course, stuff like this.
So it was an impressive round, no doubt. but what, their own sort of, what would you call it, almost political or existential expediency trumps the need to engage in anything more meaningful? Is that your...
Well, I think what has come out of in the last year or two, maybe longer, is a recognition that actually their single-minded pursuit of nuclear weapons and the missiles to launch them is not crazy. There is, you may not agree with it, I certainly don't agree with it, but it's a perfectly rational thing to do. And you look around at what happened in Libya or indeed... other countries, and you can see why someone like Kim Jong-un and the leadership of North Korea might choose to go down that route. But there are consequences, and this has put China in a very difficult position. And as I say, I think we're going to see exactly how strong China's leverage is in the next 6 to 12 months.
And I guess, Phil, that's the point, isn't it? What does that Chinese involvement, should we see any, or pressure, What does that look like? I mean, if we're talking about regimes or setups that are rather hard to second guess, I mean, I guess we look to Beijing and it's a similar problem. Do you have any, what do your instincts tell you?
Yeah, I think Victor's absolutely right. I think we're going to find out an enormous amount over the next few months about just how much clout China has, how good its intelligence is inside North Korea. I think that's a big part of this picture. And certainly on the U.S. side, that's one of the most worrying aspects, I guess, is that I think the U.S. intelligence inside North Korea is undoubtedly quite weak. China's, you would expect, is better, but to what extent exactly remains to be seen. And also, what is China's sort of larger objective in the region? I think North Korea for China fits a much bigger landscape. It's connected to China's increasingly difficult relationship with South Korea. Partly that's to do with South Korea's own political volatility. China seems uncertain what to make of that. China coming across as, I think, increasingly militaristic in the South China Sea and other parts of the Asia Pacific. So a lot of this will be about China deciding what it wants to achieve in North Korea specifically, but a lot of it will also depend on what China's sort of wider regional strategy is.
And just switching back to the US perspective once again, it's interesting they've talked about maintaining readiness, a presence in the region, which of course they have, and building on that. Is it an easy trick? Is that an easy balance to maintain a sense of being ready for whatever or having presence without being inflammatory? You know, is it a risk in and of itself to increase that presence and increase that feeling of readiness? Or do you think they're fairly old hands at dealing with that?
There are risks, clearly. I mean, whether you're putting in a missile defense system in South Korea, which is ostensibly against North Korea, but which can be perceived by China as being against them as well, all these things, there are definitely risks. I think, though, the problem is, of course, when you send a strike force like this aircraft carrier and the supporting naval vessels, at what point do you withdraw them? I mean, you can't leave it there forever, because you're tying up vital resources in a part of the world which, is very important, but it's not the only part of the world of interest to the US. So if you withdraw it, then you've got to be clear that you have achieved some of your purposes, because if you withdraw it without, then you look like a paper tiger.
And I think one of the other really important elements of this is how all of these US military actions play out in terms of domestic politics, because, of course, Trump campaigned so heavily on this America First idea, which included the notion that the US would withdraw from military involvement around the globe. We wouldn't see, you know, invasions and regime change and all the rest of it. Trump seems to be banking that there will be at least an immediate bump in the polls, because, you know, he hopes to come across as strong and forthright with these kind of military activities. But in the longer term, is this going to continue to play in his favor? I mean, there's a chance that at least some of his electoral support will say this is the kind of very expensive, very wasteful adventurism overseas that means that you're not paying enough attention to the domestic economy, jobs, employment, etc. at home. So, you know, that's a key factor in all of this, too.
It is. Can I just quickly say something on that? Trump won't be the first president to have come to power claiming that he would focus on domestic affairs. It's exactly 100 years ago since Woodrow Wilson campaigned on the campaign promise, he kept you out of the war. And a few months later, of course, he'd taken the United States into the First World War. Trump, it's one of the consequences of being the leader of a very powerful country, is that you are inevitably drawn into foreign affairs, whatever happens.
There you go. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, Victor Bulmer-Thomas and Phil Clark. After this, we look to South Africa. Stay tuned.
Tune in to the Monocle Daily on Monocle 24 weekdays at 2200 London time. We unpack the stories that have been dominating the discussion in Europe and North America and set the agenda for a new day in Asia. The show features regular insights and analysis from Monocle's bureau in Toronto and New York, special guests there and across the Americas, as well as experts and analysts at our studios in London. Whether it's industry-focused reports on anything from art and architecture to business and entertainment, or a light-hearted guide to how to spend the perfect weekend in a great city somewhere in the world, you're in good hands. Monocle's network of global correspondents are your guides. Join our team every weekday for the Monocle Daily on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. Still with me, Victor Bulmer-Thomas and Phil Clark. We head to South Africa, where last week more than 60,000 people marched in cities across the nation to demand President Jacob Zuma quit after a late-night cabinet reshuffle that has sent his presidency into crisis mode. Last night, Zuma accused these mainly peaceful protesters of racism. Phil, coming to you first of all, that cabinet reshuffle looked rather like the doings of a man desperate to cling on to power at pretty much any cost. And one rather gets the feeling that in these latest remarks, it's more of the same.
I think so. This is probably the biggest crisis that Zuma has faced in a long succession of crises. It'll be a wonder, I think, if he lasts the year. Mm-hmm. Not simply because the level of protest on the streets has been so enormous, but I think because the divisions within his own ranks are widening. And I think that's the big thing that has changed in the last week or two is, you know, voices within the ANC saying, we've had enough of this. We've had enough of the constant reshuffles. We've had enough of the corruption. We've had enough of the unpredictability of Zuma. We've had enough of the rand collapsing in value. It's lost 11% of its value just in the last week. This is a country that is potentially on the brink of something very serious in economic terms. So I think it's those internal divisions that are likely to push Zuma out at least 1 year before he's supposed to leave office.
Well, we'll talk a bit more about the sort of crisis for the country, but what about the explicitly political crisis? Because I'm sure you and I have sat around this table at several points over the last probably couple of years and said, well, this is the crisis which will, you know, split the ANC. This is the final straw. And yet here we are. I mean, many would have said that they'd be surprised that he's clung on this long and that the ANC hasn't faced this much more significant division. Is this now, though, that moment, do you think?
I think it might be, and you're absolutely right. I think this is probably the fifth time I've predicted this, at least, on Midori House over the last couple of years. And Zuma is the great survivor of not just South African politics, but at any African politics south of the Sahara. I would say it's remarkable that he's lasted as long as he has. But I think this time, I mean, just listening to the likes of Cyril Ramaphosa and, you know, others who have typically been very close allies of Zuma, even their comments have been particularly scathing. And I think there is something different in that. One thing that he's been able to rely on over the last couple of years, despite all of these hurdles and all of these pitfalls, is that there has always been a very tight coterie around him who have supported him, you know, regardless. That seems to be falling away. And I think what that probably means is that there are lots of machinations in the background. There's lots of jockeying to determine who the next leader of the ANC will be, who the next presidential candidate will be. Perhaps the only thing that could keep Zuma in power right up until the end of his term next year would be that if those players in the background can't agree on the next leader, if they can't put forward a viable candidate, then that may mean that Zuma sort of by default remains in power. But I think if those sort of players can get their act together, then he's gone pretty soon.
And Victor, I mean, it is interesting, isn't it? There's not only that loss of that coterie, as Phil describes it, but then there is this almost perfect storm about, you know, the rand losing all this value. You've got South Africa being downgraded to junk status in the last few days. Is he at the centre of now a perfect and, in a sense, inescapable storm, do you think?
No, I don't. Actually, I disagree with Phil on this, although he knows more about it than I do, so I choose my words carefully. I think it's important to remember that Zuma can't stand in the presidential election in 2019. So grim though it might be for South Africa, there is light at the end of this particular tunnel. And if I was Zuma, I would be thinking, well, you know, the rand, it only fell 11%. Well, after Brexit, it fell 20%, as I remember. 60,000 on the street. In a population of 40 million, that's not a huge number. It was led by the Democratic Alliance, mainly white organization, not as white as it used to be, but it still is very much a white vehicle in South Africa. So there are lots of things that might lead him to grasp at straws. But I think the key, as Phil pointed out, is that there is no obvious successor. And he is a past master playing off one group against another. And so I think he will actually survive.
And that's interesting. I mean, we've talked a lot again on this program about the crisis in political personnel and how frequently, despite these crises, there just simply isn't the kind of people coming through to galvanise the public. I wonder in South Africa, but given there's so much uncertainty, it's so turbulent, are there likely candidates who'll say, hey, do you know what? I'm better off giving this 18 months because what am I going to, let's say I take over tomorrow, how do I personally bring in an agenda that can dig us out of this problem?
Yeah, I think that's certainly part of the calculation. I think with someone like Ramaphosa, who, you know, 2 years ago was the odds-on favourite to be the next president, I think he would look at the current situation and think, I really need this to settle down. We need to get a predictable finance minister in place. We need to stabilise the economy. We need to, you know, become a kind of a reasonable regional player. Once again, who would want to inherit this absolute mess. I think the other thing that, you know, is playing into this is that the ANC is very worried about the increasing influence of the opposition parties. And the Democratic Alliance have been very successful in terms of provincial politics, winning both Cape Town and Pretoria at the recent local elections. They're also increasingly worried about the economic freedom fighters, the EFF, who have been, you know, sort of relegated as firebrands for a very long time, but who are inch by inch gaining traction in South African politics. You can hear even the ANC having to adopt a rhetoric around land redistribution, you know, having to really tackle inequality. You know, these have been hallmarks of the EFF's platform for the last few years. So the ANC, you know, finds itself in a very difficult position at the moment. It can't be as complacent about opposition parties as it has done in the past. And that would be the kind of thing that worries its leadership, is Zuma's behaviour has become so erratic and the country is suffering as a result. Are we opening ourselves up to these opposition parties to become increasingly strong and to maybe even, you know, win some significant battles at both the presidential and the national elections in 2019? So I think that's part of the calculation too.
We'll keep a weather eye on that. Finally, on today's programme, though, we look to the skies and United Airlines, which has been making headlines after forcibly removing a passenger from an overbooked flight. Victor, this has kind of been doing the round somewhat. I think our listeners are familiar with the story. Not quite as simple as I described. He was asked to volunteer to give up his seat. He said he was a doctor with patients to see. The airline's response, though, has been intriguing, and it's rather blown up in their face. What do you make of this? Is this a crisis that could largely have been averted with a cannier PR operation?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if when seeking volunteers they'd gone from $1,000 to $10,000, they'd have found the plane emptied very quickly. Actually, I can remember being in one of these auctions, and I think it was from Miami to Buenos Aires, and they started at 200 no takers, 400 no takers. When they got to 1,000, half the plane jumped up and said, I'll take it, you know. So there is a price at which people would go. The second thing is, if it was all to do with getting four United employees to some other place so they could work the next day, well, charter a small plane. I mean, you know, it's not the end of the world.
I sense these sorts of pragmatic and practical decisions, they will rather wish that they had done them after all that we've seen in the last couple of days. But what about the involvement then of, you know, the top brass, the CEO, Oscar Munoz? He sends a letter to staff insisting they follow procedures. There's this sort of apologies that have been bandying around. I mean, that's a bad story because you see the airline, you know, stock price starts to tumble. I mean, companies can really tie themselves in knots over this.
Yeah, United have handled this terribly. I mean, I think it shows a couple of things. One is that apparently you can't give people $2,000 to travel to Louisville. So I don't know what that says. With apologies to all of Monocle's vast listenership in Louisville. But also I think it shows airlines are just generally under pressure at the moment. That it's the whole industry has found the last few years extremely difficult in terms of, you know, oil prices and competition and all the rest of it. But also, you know, airlines are having to carry this massive security burden from governments, and not least US airlines and US airports, I think, are places that are just under pressure. There's a real kind of powder keg mentality. And airlines, I think, deeply resent that they are often the ones having to screen passengers. They are having to, in essence, do government bidding, basically doing the things that we would expect states to have to do. And I think in the background, it's leading to the kinds of decisions that we've seen United make over the last couple of days. Very heavy-handed tactics, no one thinking clearly. It's an industry that's very hot at the moment.
And Victor, just briefly, a final word. It always puts me in mind of a political crisis where it's not the initial misdeed that gets you, it's the lies about it. In this case, badly handled at the moment, yes, but surely if you get a quality statement, if you get the top brass on board straight away to paper over the cracks, you can dig yourself out of any crisis, can't you?
I think the original misdeed was pretty shocking. I mean, when you beat up a doctor, and of course there's the racial profiling aspect of this story, which is very disturbing as well. But you beat him up and he comes back with blood pouring down his face. I think it's going to take an awful lot of apologies for people to forget that.
Well, I hope they're tuning in and they keep their pencils sharpened for more of those apologies. Victor, we'll leave it there. Victor Wilmer-Thomas and Phil Clark, thanks both for joining us. On today's edition of Midori House, that's all we have time for. The programme was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Antti Longo. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. Thanks to all of them. More music next, Section D on the way at 1900. And we'll have more for you on all the big stories of the day on the Monocle Daily at 2200. Do stay tuned for that. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.